Welcome, everybody, to the Across the Sky podcast. I'm meteorologist Joe Martucci at the Press of Atlantic City. It takes more than one person to get this podcast done, though. We are a operation of four all across Lee Enterprises, our parent company. And join with me, we have Sean Sublett in Richmond, Kirsten Lang in Tulsa, and Matt Hollander covering the Midwest. Everybody, spring is firmly in the air. How are we all doing today?
We are good here in Richmond. We're looking forward to the warmer weather for sure. The pollen is still flying around, but we're enjoying the warmer weather for sure.
And we are in full bloom in Tulsa. I will tell you, it's been difficult, I think, for some dealing with allergies here in this part of the country.
We're even thawing out in the Midwest, where it's been cold for seemingly an endless amount of time. But finally, we got temperatures in the 70s, even 80s in spots. It's like, wow, what's warm weather?
I'm always like a step between Sean and Matt here, being in New Jersey, between the colder Midwest, and Sean's a little bit milder there. We are trying to bloom here in late April, but it's warming up a little bit. And as we go forward in time, it'll start blooming. And, you know, with spring on our minds, we wanted to bring in a special guest, somebody that Sean and I both, we've talked to before for different stories, extremely nice person, Teresa Crimmins. She is the director for the USA National Phenology Network and has been there since 2007. Now, she's actually from the Midwest, so she'll offer some northern perspective, but she's actually based right now in Arizona, where it is, well, warmer than in New Jersey, that's for sure. But we're going to turn it over to Teresa. We'll have her say hi, introduce yourself a little bit. And then we got a couple of questions as we go into the spring season. We're going to talk about pollen. We'll talk about her network, et cetera, et cetera. But Teresa, thanks for being on. We appreciate it.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much. I'm very excited to get to chat with you about one of my favorite topics, which is what the plants and animals are doing right now.
It's starting to bud here in the Northeast, and you know, varying levels of bloom and leaf out here across the area. You know, Teresa, just tell us, you know, how did you get from the Midwest down to Arizona?
Graduate school. I'll be honest. So I grew up in the Midwest. I actually was born in Ohio, but I grew up in Michigan. But my family was really into camping, and we would go on these really awesome vacations every summer where we would drag a trailer and kind of progressively go farther and farther afield from Michigan. And once me and my sister got old enough that we could tolerate long car rides, we started exploring the West and all the awesome national parks in Wyoming and Utah and Arizona and Colorado. And it was pretty much at that point in my life that I realized I really want to live out West. It's just so cool. And so when my husband and I were applying for graduate programs, I may not have gone about this in the most wise way, rather than selecting a program based on the person who might advise me or the rigor of the program, I actually chose it based on the location. And funny enough, my husband and I both applied to Arizona State, which is in Phoenix, and U of A, which is down in Tucson. And my husband was able to get his trip to visit paid by ASU. So when we visited colleges before committing, he visited ASU, but he felt uncomfortable coming down to Tucson to visit U of A. But I didn't have anybody paying my way. So I was like, I'm coming down here. And as soon as I drove down to Tucson, I decided this is the place for me, not Phoenix. And then I proceeded to convince him that, yes, you should come to the University of Arizona with me. We're not going to live in Phoenix and go to ASU. And so he actually committed sight unseen and didn't see Tucson until we drove in and basically started to live here and attend school. And then it just kind of went from there. I really do love it here. I really do. It's a great city and it's a great climate. And so we were able, fortunate enough to get jobs and stay.
So you were the deciding factor. That's what it sounds like.
Yep.
First question is, like, what the heck is phenology? Like, why should people care about phenology?
I know, that's a pretty off-putting word. It sounds old-fashioned. A lot of times people confuse it with the bumps on your head, which is actually phrenology. But I would like to make the case that phenology is actually a topic that's almost as easy to chat about in the grocery line as the weather. Pretty much whenever you're meeting strangers, when you get an awkward pause, you tend to, you know, look out the window and say, well, it's been nice. It's been warm lately. Or, oh, how about these storms we've been having? And I do think that it's pretty easy too to chat with people about, man, the pollen is terrible. Oh my gosh, my allergies are killing me. Or Wow, look at the beautiful blooms. I love how, like, right now here in Tucson, our Palo Verde trees are in peak flower, and they're just huge, huge, beautiful canopies full of yellow flowers. And it's so gorgeous. Those events, those seasonal events, and when they take place is what phenology refers to. The timing of seasonal events like flowering or leaf out or migration or egg hatch in plants and animals. So I really wish our organization was not named the Phenology Network. I wish it was named the Seasonal Event Network or anything other than that off-putting word, because it is something that we all do pay attention to and celebrate, I think, on a daily basis.
I think there's a lot of parallels between weather words and what you're talking about, phenology, things that we wish were simpler, but we just have this long word or, you know, kind of confusing word. I want to give a shout out to your website real quick. You're a National Phenology Network website, because if you go there, it's usanpn.org. I mean, right there on the homepage, there's these two maps that like update every day. You could just like watch it on loop forever. One shows the first leaf index, right? And whether it's coming earlier or later than usual. And then the other one is the first bloom index and whether it's earlier or later than usual. And you can just see it kind of trickle from Florida and Arizona up into the, you know, the rest of the South and then on up into the rest of the country. It's a really cool site. A lot of cool colors on there. Cool to see. When you go to the website, what do you hope people get out of it when they go there?
Oh, that's a great question. I hope that they are excited about what they're seeing. I hope that they are able to draw connections between maybe what they're seeing on this map and what they're seeing out the window. And hopefully, even so inspired by that, to have a conversation about what's going on and maybe even document what they're seeing formally. One of the really major activities that we undertake is to try and engage folks of all ages and backgrounds in formally tracking when events occur in plants and animals, typically in their backyards, in some place that's accessible, because having formal documentation of when those things are occurring enables us to then better understand how things are changing, how things may have changed, what the conditions are that are associated with activities such as leaf out or flowering. And so I hope that folks actually get excited about this and want to participate.
Well, I'm definitely excited every time I go to your website, so you can count me in for that. Sean, you know, you and Teresa have talked a couple times in the past. I'll toss it over to you. The floor is yours, my man.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. And again, Teresa, it's so good to have you here. One of the things that I've kind of tried to lock around in my head is, how in the world are you able to get all of this data? One, processing, it's another beast. I imagine that's mostly just a, you know, computer processing thing. But where do you get what appears to be very high resolution data about where things are blooming and or leafing out?
So there's a couple of different things going on. The maps that Joe referenced, the maps that are indicating when we're starting to see leaf out or when we're starting to see bloom, and whether that's earlier or later than normal, are actually generated using a model and using daily minimum and maximum temperature data. How those are constructed is there is a long historical record observations of when lilacs and honeysuckle plants have leafed out and flowered across the country that were contributed by volunteer observers starting back in the 1950s and all the way up. This has continued through the present, and we have many observers across the country tracking leaf out and flowering in lilacs now. And I'll get to that in a sec, because we would love for more people to track lilacs too. Some researchers were able to take those observations and identify how much temperature needs to be accumulated, or how much warmth do lilac individual plants and honeysuckles need to be exposed to in the spring in order for them to basically get going with their springtime activity and to start to leaf out and to start to flower. Those plants are among the plants that leaf out or flower the earliest in the season. And so the conditions that are associated with when they leaf out or when they flower, basically, we interpret that as the conditions that represent the biological start to spring. And so that leaf, we call it the leaf index, because it's really actually a set of conditions that are associated with leafing out in lilacs and honeysuckles, but also the leading, basically, activity at the start of spring. That's really what it's kind of communicating. is, have we seen those conditions that are associated with the biological start of spring? Are those conditions happening earlier or later in this year than they have in the past? And it really equates to, have things been warmer or cooler than average so far this winter and spring?
Are those two, I guess, species or families, honeysuckle and lilacs, are they common throughout the continental United States?
Yeah, they are. We don't really have them too much in the southern states. They can be cultivated in folks' yards, but definitely, like where I'm at in Arizona, those plants are not growing here on their own out in the Sonoran Desert. But, you know, if I try to water one and really love it, it could grow here. But yeah, they are generally pretty common in much of the rest of the country. And they were selected in part because their springtime activity is triggered simply by wintertime and springtime warmth. And so therefore, they really are a good indicator of how warm has it been and what is spring looking like in this year at this location.
One question, then I want to toss it to Kirsten after this. In the years that we have this data, have you noticed any trends? I mean, we know that the planet is warming. Have you seen any kind of long-term trends? Do you have enough data to tease out any kind of long-term trends?
That is a great question. So the beautiful thing about these spring index models is they're a model. And so when you have a model, basically you can use that to estimate when something is happening in the present, like we are doing with these the maps that we're generating real time this year. We can also calculate them going back in time to figure out when were those conditions met at different locations in years past. And we can use them to project forward as to when we think those conditions might be met in future years under future conditions. When we calculate them back in time and look to see if things have changed, there are very clear trends. And it's advancing. Basically, we are, for the most part, achieving the conditions associated with leaf out and flowering in these different species, as indicated by these models, significantly earlier, progressively earlier from year to year to year. The other thing that I wanted to mention, though, is in addition to these models that we're running to generate these maps, we again have that program that I sort of mentioned before, which is called Nature's Notebook, where anybody can track the phenology, the seasonal events in over 1,600 species of plants and animals in their yard. We launched Nature's Notebook in 2009, and since that date, we've had close to 30 million records be contributed on all different species of plants and animals across the whole country, and on all the different types of events too, not just springtime activity like leaf out and flowering, but also autumn activity like leaf color change and leaf fall and fall migration. And those data are being increasingly used by scientists and by decision makers to try to understand how things have maybe changed, as well as what's happening in real time in the current year. And to get to your question, Sean, yes, researchers have taken those observations and looked for signs of change, even in this short span of time. One of the best examples of that is where some researchers took all of the records of flowering in black cherry trees that have been contributed to the program, to Nature's Notebook, and then combined it with a whole bunch of records that they gleaned from herbarium records. Herbarium records it's basically like a library of plant samples. And this was a really popular activity historically, where folks would go out on botany field trips and collect plant samples. And what you're doing when you're collecting an herbarium record is basically collecting a sample of a plant, then it's pressed and dried and glued on a page. So you just have a flat plant. And when you create that record, you also document where it was collected and when it was collected. And the fabulous thing is that people did this a ton back in the 1800s and 1900s. We can now mine those records because they tell us where and when things were collected. And if those plant samples that were documented have evidence of flowering on them, for example, then we know when and where that plant was in flower historically. And so these researchers took all these dead flat plant samples from the herbaria, figured out when and where black cherry trees were in flower, and then compared that to what's been contributed in recent years by participants in our program, And they were able to show a real clear trend toward earlier flowering in recent years, consequent with increasing temperatures in recent years.
So Teresa, I have, I guess, kind of piggybacking off of that, there was an article that was recently put out from the Associated Press that was talking about this. In that article, allergists are now saying that pollen season in the U.S. used to start around St. Patrick's Day, and now it starts as early as Valentine's Day. Would you say that that's accurate?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that work, and it seems consistent with so many other forms of evidence that we have and studies that have been documenting change in activity in plants and animals. Allergies are right in line, you know, pollen in the air is right in line with flowering because it's flowers are where the pollen come from. And you can't have pollen in the air unless the flowers are blooming. And so that's actually an active area of research for us right now among our team is to evaluate, can the observations of flowers that folks are contributing to Nature's Notebook, to the program that we maintain, tell us a bit more about where and when different plant taxa are releasing their pollen, and so therefore where folks might be suffering from allergies, especially if you're sensitive to certain plant groups over others. So yeah, to answer your question, yeah, it does seem like the allergy season is coming earlier, lasting longer, and actually potentially even intensifying and has the potential to intensify going forward. So the reason why we're having warmer temperatures in the spring, I know you all know, is because of increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Both of those ingredients, the carbon dioxide and the temperature, serve to help plants grow better and larger. It's like a fertilizing effect for them. And when you have larger trees, they can release more pollen. And so then there's just more pollen in the air. And then further, this is more bad news. It's just a handful of studies that have indicated this, but there's also been some papers that have suggested that with more carbon dioxide in the air and the increased warmth, plants like ragweed, which are problematic for allergy sufferers, are producing more allergenic pollen too. So it's kind of bad news if we are facing a atmosphere and a world where we don't curb emissions.
That's real interesting, you know, thinking about all these different aspects and whether it's not just that it's occurring earlier and because of the temperatures, but the amount of carbon dioxide. I think that's fascinating. I'm curious to know if you're noticing any trend in the regions across the U.S. Is there a particular region where it seems like the blooms are happening earlier or you're seeing a particular uptick? Is there some regional variation or is it pretty uniform across the entire country?
That's a great question. Again, the spring indices are really the measure that we can interpret with the greatest confidence. But yeah, we tend to see greater advancement in the northeastern U.S. and in definitely the southwestern U.S. and a little bit less in the southeast. That's been kind of attributed to this phenomenon referred to as the warming hole. And you guys can probably talk about the atmospheric dynamics that are behind that. But my understanding of it is that there just hasn't been as significant of an increase in warm temperatures in that part of the country. And so consequently, we don't see as great of a magnitude and increase in the timing of flowering and leaf out in those species as we do in some of those other parts of the country.
I just want to go back to what's happening now this spring. Kind of to the opposite point about earlier places, I'm seeing it looks like in Texas and in New Mexico is the latest spring on record in a couple of spots. So what was going on there? I mean, was it just that cool all season long?
That's a good catch. You must be looking at those return interval maps.
Yes.
That's really good.
I tell you, I get on the website. I love it. I'm not lying.
I'm so impressed. That's super. Yeah. So how you were able to determine that is one of the things that we do is take those current year maps and kind of try to put them into the context of the last several decades and interpret it in a way that hopefully is meaningful for folks who are visiting the website. And you can look at a specific location and get a sense for, is this, say, the earliest spring we've seen on record or the latest spring we've seen on record, or is it kind of right in the middle? And yeah, you're right. There were spots in Texas that did show it was really late, right?
It was. It was actually Kirsten and Matt's hometown in San Antonio that was included in that.
You guys are going to have to tell me, honestly. What I can tell you is what causes a location to pop up as late on the map means that it just took it much longer than average to achieve the amount of warmth that the plants need in the winter and the spring months to finally get going and do their thing. And so if you had a number of just cold spells or cold events, or it was just steadily below average temperatures, either set of those conditions could just delay plant response. And so, yeah, are either of you more familiar? I know last year we had a similar situation in Texas, and I could kind of explain it from the big cold event in February that had knocked out the power, but I don't know as much about this year. So I'm hoping one of you experts can do that.
I'm trying to look real quick to just see if it was below average. I would imagine it's something to do with it was fairly chilly during those months, but I'm usually honed in on New Jersey, not so much on Texas and New Mexico, but I'm sure that was the case.
Well, I wonder if precipitation has something to do with it too. Does that play a role in addition to temperatures? Does the amount of precipitation have an influence on when things bloom and when the start of spring is, like based on the amount of precipitation that happens during the winter, for example?
Precipitation is not actually an input to the spring index models. These models basically are just an indication of, they're kind of a glorified heat index. The truth is, though, a lot of plants do respond to precipitation. And so we do get a lot of folks that'll look at these maps and then counter and say, your map is saying one thing, but what I'm seeing is something really different. And that makes sense because every species responds to different conditions. And in truth, it can be a whole combination of factors that influence when different species of plants leaf out and flower. Some species need to achieve a particular amount of chill that they get exposed to in the spring, and then they start paying attention to warmth. And so you can have really funky things going on in years where you have very warm conditions very early in the year, because if those species that require the chill don't achieve the chill before they start getting exposed to the warmth, a lot of them don't pay attention to the warmth. And so even though it's warmer and warmer and warmer and they should be responding, they just sit dormant because they keep thinking, it's not time yet. I need my chill. And so that can actually cause them to delay their activity, which seems completely counter to what you would expect. Some other species require day length, have a day length cue. So they won't pay attention to warmth, early warmth either, if the days aren't long enough for them. And then you're right, Matt, especially where I'm at, precipitation is a major factor. So if we don't have sufficient moisture, for example, a lot of the annual plants that flower in the springtime right now are really responsive to what happened last October. And we didn't have any rain at all last October. And so we are kind of seeing many of those annuals out on the landscape like we do when we have a nice wet fall. So yeah, these index maps, they're an approximation of what plants might be doing, but they are definitely the most representative of plants that only care about the accumulation of warmth in the spring.
Teresa, whenever this Associated Press article came out, it was something my editor encouraged me to look into a little bit more. And so I spoke with somebody at our National Weather Service office here in Tulsa. I had her pull up some maps, or rather some data, temperature trends, just from the month of March specifically here in Tulsa, just to try to see, you know, how things have been changing over the years. And one thing that she was asking me to actually ask somebody just like you about was if there was a certain degree that the plants, and I'm sure this is going to vary across the country, but that plants are kind of looking for to trigger to start emerging from that dormant state that they might be in, which in turn would change, of course, with the warmings that we may be seeing or that we may have seen over the years.
Predicting when plants might undergo activity can be kind of generalized in terms of what's a average daily temperature below which they're not going to respond. And that's generally referred to as a base temperature. And then how much warmth do you need for that plant to be exposed to above that base temperature, which will accumulate over probably days or weeks. And that is often characterized as something called a growing degree threshold. And that's basically just the language for how much warmth does the organism need to be exposed to above that base temperature. And those growing degree day quantities are used fairly regularly in agriculture and integrated pest management, because in laboratory settings, it's been established of what exactly is the base temperature for those organisms and how much warmth do they need to be exposed to before they will, say, hatch from their eggs or put on those leaves. The trick is those two values vary by organism. everybody really has a different base temperature and a different amount of warmth that they have to get exposed to do something. And it's not even consistent across a species range. You know, plants adapt to the local conditions. And so we know, for example, red maple trees grow from Florida to Maine, and they take a lot more warmth to be exposed to in different parts of that range to actually be responsive. And also in a lot of species, we just haven't really hammered out what those numbers are. And that's part of what folks are doing actively with the data set that we manage and maintain is take those raw observations and try to back calculate, try to figure out, you know, what are the drivers to leaf out or to flowering or to egg hatch in these species? Because if we know that, then we can better predict forward how that timing might change in the future and therefore what the consequences could be for such change.
Thinking forward on that, what kind of things do you have planned for the future there at the National Phenology Network? Do you have some other cool things in the works, or are you kind of just holding what you have right now? What are some of the other cool things that might be waiting in the wings?
So in addition to the spring index maps that we've talked about that indicate the timing of spring kind of generally, we have a whole series of maps that we refer to as pheno forecasts, which are maps that are updated on a daily basis that indicate when a particular event in a particular organism is anticipated to occur. And in a lot of cases, those are based on the growing degree day thresholds. And a number of those maps that we have right now, we make available for species that require management action. And so a really good example of that is for emerald ash borer, which is an insect that bores into underneath the bark of ash trees and is really having a devastating impact on ash trees across their range. And it's a pretty tough insect to control, one reason being that they spend most of their life cycle under the bark of the trees. However, they do emerge as adults and fly around, and they fly around for about 2 weeks before they lay their eggs and start the whole life cycle again. When those adults emerge is a opportune time to try to trap them and prevent them from spreading to new trees and infecting additional individuals. And what's great is that it's been established that it's about 450 growing degree days that need to be accumulated at a location that will trigger the emergence of those adults. So if we can just calculate on a daily basis what locations across the country have achieved 450 growing degree days, then we can have a better sense of when and where those critters might be emerging and managers might want to be taking action. So we have those maps and those are being updated on a daily basis and you can access it on any day and see, is your location at that threshold, close to it, where you might want to be gearing up to be taking activity, nowhere near it, so you can sit tight and wait, or way past it and you missed your window. And so we've had good success with those maps and with folks who are trying to plan their management activities accessing them. And so we're trying to expand that to a bunch more species and in several different directions too. We recently spread into agriculture a little bit, where we have maps that indicate the developmental stage of winter wheat. And this is relevant for the Midwest in particular, because if winter wheat is exposed to killing frosts after it's started to starting to grow back in the spring, it grows in the fall and then it sits dormant. And it's very frost tolerant then. But once it starts getting warmth in the spring and starts growing, then it's not frost tolerant. And if it gets hit by a frost then you have a problem. And so we have maps that indicate the developmental status for better helping in the agricultural realm. We want to expand more in that area. And we're definitely expanding more into the human health realms, things like better trying to predict pollen across the country at different species or taxonomic groups. And most recently are working with some folks to try to predict the seasonality of mosquitoes, and especially those that are vectors for bad diseases like Zika and West Nile virus and all those ones that we really don't want to get exposed to. So the timing of stuff seasonally it touches almost every aspect of our lives, honestly. And so we're kind of trying to push into all those different directions to figure out what information is the most useful for folks to have that indicates when different events might occur that would help you make better decisions and live a better life.
For sure, because I think about the mosquitoes all the time here in Virginia. They haven't kicked out just yet, but I know that time is coming. And yeah, it does seem like they're lasting a lot longer into the fall.
You know what? I wanted to go back to what you were saying maybe like 10 minutes or so ago about, you know, being earlier or later with the leaf out. Do you do anything on the other end of that, like tracking? I guess it's all, I would say foliage, but you know, not even specifically, you know, the leaves turning yellow and red. You guys track on the end stage of that?
Yeah, such a good question. We definitely do have a growing pool of data that's documenting those kinds of things that participants in the Nature's Notebook program are contributing. We don't yet have maps that are continuous across the country that indicate this the way that we do for spring. We've been asked for it a lot, and I definitely agree that that would be so cool. The reason we haven't yet achieved that is it's a lot more complicated. Fall color change seems to be a combination of chill and moisture availability. You know, drought definitely has an interactive effect where if it's been really dry, you don't really even get great colors. It just kind of goes straight to senescence and the leaves fall off. And it just seems a lot more variable across different groups of plants. It's a lot harder to have a single index that says, okay, this represents fall and this is what's happening. There are a couple of nice map products out there that other organizations offer up, and we've reached out to them. We can't, they've never shared with us how they are making the predictions that they are. So that's still an active area of development for us. And I unfortunately don't have a time frame for that one because our program is funded by a combination of grants and contributions from different federal agencies. And to be honest, the things that get requested by the funders are the things that get prioritized. And right now, the fall maps are not among those products, unfortunately. I am disheartened by that because I definitely recognize their value and utility for folks in the media to be able to access and for communicating with the public. And I love that. So I hope that we can get to it eventually.
I almost feel like you can make money off of those maps. You know, I think people would love to see that.
That has been suggested, like partner up with the tourism industry.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking. The departments of tourism, especially, you know, in the Rockies and the Appalachians, they would really love to see that data.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many ideas and just not enough time right now.
But we'll have to have you come on back and then you can tell us about all the new stuff that, you know, let's go on. Hopefully there'll be more updates on the fall end of this. The website again for Synology Networks, usanpn.org. You're also on Twitter as well. I believe it's just your name. Is that correct?
Yep. At Teresa Crimmins, TheresaCrimmins.
Awesome. We appreciate the time, Teresa. Thanks again. And we're looking forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Awesome. Thank you all so much. I'm so honored and it was really fun.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We're going to take a brief break, everybody, on the other side. We're going to wrap it on up before we get out of here. This is the Across the Sky podcast. A big thank you to Dr. Teresa Crimmins for coming on. She's spoken with Sean before. She's spoken with me before. It was good to have her here with all of us. I usually learn a lot from her, and I hope everybody else did. I think we did, right? I think we learned a lot about leaves and planting and blooming and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the really cool thing for me is to see how spring, that classical spring, or how the plants react to that, how that is very different in different parts of the country, depending on what the winter has been like, because we know that not everybody has seasonal winters. One part of the country might be cooler than normal. Another part might be warmer than normal. And it is very interesting to watch how that progresses from south to north as the springtime goes on. And it is very different from year to year, for sure.
Yeah, it was real interesting getting to chat with her and also all the little details that matter. I think one of the things I've noticed in the Midwest, you know, a lot of people have been talking about, you know, how it's been a pretty cold winter in the Midwest. We've had a lot of cold fronts and it seems like we can't really warm up. But what's interesting, I think this is where it comes back to looking at average temperature, because one of the interesting things that's been happening is that we've had a lot of cold days where our high temperatures are below normal, but there have been a lot of nights where the temperatures actually haven't been that cold. So we're below normal during the day, but actually above normal temperatures at night. And so I think that goes a long way into figuring out, you know, how temperatures are changing with time, because actually what we're seeing really across the country is that low temperatures are rising faster than high temperatures are. And I've definitely seen that this winter in the Midwest, where, yes, we've had some cold days where we haven't warmed up very much, but we also aren't cooling down at night. So it's not like we've been talking about a lot of record low temperatures set, you know, where we should have like record lows maybe in the 20s, like we're only cooling down into the 30s at night. So even though it's cool during the day, it's not necessarily really all that cold at night. And so people might think it's been a cold winter, but if you look at the low temperatures and the average temperature, really hasn't been all that cold.
Yeah. And in Tulsa too, you know, just the amount of allergies that are, or I should say the amount of people that suffer from allergies from blooming in this part of the country is high. And I mean, all along the plains. And I think it's something that a lot of people take interest in, not only here, but across the country. So very cool job. Very cool to be able to talk with someone who knows so much about it all.
Do you guys keep the windows closed all spring long because of the allergies?
I don't initially, but I will tell you here in the Middle Atlantic, I don't know about you, Joe, there in South Jersey, but last week the pollen was crazy, off the hook, nuts, all that stuff last week. It's backed off a little bit. We had a good soaking rain here several days ago, so that kind of washed things out. But our leaves are really jumping. So I imagine our pollen has peaked. I'd like to have the windows open, but there were a few days last week. It's like, no way can I keep these windows open at all.
My wife gets very allergic, so we have it closed from April through about June. And then if you can squeak out a nice refreshing day in July and August, then they're back open. But I actually used to be like really allergic to pollen. Like I used to have like the nebulizer and everything, you know, like breathing into that little machine. But I don't know, like now in my old age, I feel like I've outgrown pollen. So I wish I had this when I was like 14 years old, because my birthday is May 13th, which is like peak pollen time. So a lot of my birthdays also came with itchy and watery eyes.
Oh.
Now I'm just chilling, you know, on my birthday, but I'm not really doing much.
That's a foreign concept for some people in the South, opening their windows in June or July. That absolutely does not happen.
Yeah, I mean, that does not happen.
After
here,
literally spending 3 years in deep South Texas, that air conditioner is cranked all summer long and you keep those windows closed.
But here, you know what? Hold on though. I have a theory real quick though about this, because I've been to Florida a couple times during the summer. I almost feel like there might be an over air conditioning when you get too far south.
Yes. Oh my heavens. There was one time I was like, it's Lakeland, Florida. And this has been several years ago. It was in July. So Florida in July, we went to some restaurant and I swear it was 62 degrees inside of that restaurant. I'm like, you're kidding, right? I mean, really, we don't need to go this far to the other direction. Just knock the humidity down, get the temperature to 72. All is fine. But man, you know, it's July, Florida. I got shorts on and just this little polo shirt. I went and it was freezing, man, freezing.
I watched something, maybe on like CBS, about why the air conditioning in like office buildings are sometimes really cold, because it's a power move so that I can control my environment.
See, we need to have like a whole episode where we discuss, you know, temperatures and weather impacts on people's, and instead of just animal behavior and plant behavior, how it affects people behavior, because
we can do an air conditioning one. I got plenty of air conditioning theories and stories to back these up.
I'm sure we would get some hot takes on that, on the debate on what's the ideal temperature to be inside.
Oh yeah.
There's a lot of opinions there.
Were you trying to be punny there? Was that a pun?
A little bit.
Good podcast, everybody. I hope everybody here enjoyed it. Next Monday, we're going to do a little tornado talk. All of us are going to, just the four of us, we're going to talk about some stories and some experiences we had covering tornadoes in, you know, the plains are different than tornadoes in Virginia and different than tornadoes in New Jersey. So we'll give you a little perspective about what we've seen across our travels in the United States with tornadoes. But otherwise, that's it, everybody. This is the Across the Sky podcast, brought to you by Lee Enterprises. We have new episodes every Monday. You can check it out wherever you get your podcasts or on our respective websites. We have Sean at the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Kirsten at the Tulsa World. Matt's covering, where are we at now, Matt? 32 sites in the Midwest? Is that where we're at?
All over the Midwest. Yeah, 32 communities.
32 communities in the Midwest, and I'm here at pressofac.com. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you next Monday. Stay safe and enjoy.